what he's describing. Like you said, the in-breath and the out-breath, it's like Om, right? It's the three sections of Om with the absolute above it as that crescent with the dot, you know, the principle of the thing. But yeah, no, this is the thing, is that Crowley's all about false flag terrorism. I mean, he's with the sinking of the Lusitania and all of that, but that's like Tisha B'Av was an act of false flag terrorism. And the only distinction that's being made in the text that I'm looking at between what is our 9/11 versus the 11/9s of the past is that the whole world sees it this time. And whereas people were able to be manipulated on a mass scale through this action, through the destruction of the temple, this time we're seeing the trade center get destroyed, which is the most material, that's the biggest epitome of like what we could come up with to communicate this in its extension, right? So you have this World Trade Center, but the fact that everyone knows what they saw, it's just they see it on a subconscious level, they know what they saw, but they have to reconcile that, and that it sets something into motion, and that is, you know, I mean, we could have chosen a different route, we could have taken a different route, and we didn't, but now that we're here, this is what we're dealing with, and because we're at where we're at, you have to go through the muck and the mire to see what underlies it. You know, it's like that dot in the middle of the six-pointed star in the Indian tradition, you know, where you're like, there's no way around this, the only way beyond is directly through. That's like the 216, 6 times 6 times 6, you know, 72 times 3, which is Hesed. So we basically have to go through this thing because it's what we're in the midst of. It's really tough.
Well, it's, yeah, I would, that's what I mean by it's just Trump time. This is what happens at this point in the timeline, you know.
Right, it's how.
Hey, can
Trump is essentially how.
Can I ask a question of you guys as far as the Trump time? Just real quick. All right, so whatever anyone's feelings might be on Alex Jones, which I have, of course, my own feelings on, but something occurred to me the other day, which is, this idea of him promoting Trump, right?
You could, blowing my mind.
Well, I was gonna say is like, so for some people they're like, see, this is proof he's a disinfo agent, or for other people this is whatever proof that he's a freedom fighter or whatever the fuck. I don't care. Point is, here's my question: as a guy whose entire career is built around fighting the establishment, and perhaps this very same thing is true of Trump himself, to maybe. Mm-hmm. What happens once you are the establishment? Like, if you're Alex Jones and you're like, the government is lying to us, blah, blah, blah. Oh, here's an honest man running for president. Everyone support Trump and blah, blah, blah. Now, let's say this dude fucking wins. And now you're Alex Jones and you have to do your show on, you know, in your 2017, Trump's in the White House. And you have to get on the airwaves that day. What the fuck do you say to your listeners? At what point do you say
you sell them the same survival supplements? Like,
right. But I'm saying if they're supposed to trust this guy that you told them to vote for, how do you tell them? So you either then turn around and be like, "Never mind, I was wrong. This guy's a dickbag. The government's out to get you again," or what?
I think he'd end up landing on that. I mean, he was pro Ron Paul as well, so
Ron Paul didn't make it. That's what I'm saying. Ron Paul didn't make it. So what happens when they actually make – if you think Trump's going to win, and it sure as fuck looks that way, I'm saying what happens to your Alex Jones and your Red Ices and all these shitheads that are like, hey, support this guy. What happens when we have a quote-unquote anti-establishment supported by the alternative media guy in the White House? What I'm saying, when Red Ice or Alex Jones, they have to do a radio show in 2017, what the hell do they say to their listeners? And that's, I mean, this is a really legitimate question.
Is Red Ice pro-Trump? I haven't listened to it for a number of years for a variety of fairly obvious reasons.
well, right, exactly.
Is Henrik pro-Trump?
I know they've done a few pro-Trump things. See, it's interesting because they position themselves as anarchists, but then we're speaking supporting of Trump's ideas. So again, right? You're an anarchist until you agree with somebody, and then suddenly you're a fascist. You're like, no, trust this benevolent dictator because he's got all the right ideas.
I honestly think as soon as especially kind of coming back to the metaphysics of what we were talking about, where it is just Trump time, if / when he wins, he's going to have the same thing The only like decently written or decently thought through article I ever read in The Guardian about Obama was essentially the day after he won in whatever it was, 2007, that said he can't but not disappoint people at this point in time. And Trump's going to be the same. Like he will win because it's, well, I think he'll win because it's Trump time. But none of that stuff, well, none of that stuff's going to happen.
Right.
There's not going to be, it doesn't work that way. I mean, having to run that sort of rogue bureaucracy in Washington. So there will be enough for Alex Jones to complain about while selling supplements once Trump's in the White House.
Yeah, I'm just like, I'm really, maybe this is not as big a question for you guys as it is for me. I'm just sort of, I'm fascinated to see how they backpedal from that.
Well, they're already backpedaling in the midst, in a sense. I mean, I just watched this thing happen where he said he got attacked by communists. He's shouting there at these people with the loudspeaker. He shows up, you know, to a rally or whatever for Black Lives Matter, and he's shouting at everyone that they're cop killers. Well, you know what I mean? You're already playing sides, and it's so chaotic. It doesn't make any sense. It's helter skelter, essentially. I mean, you got this massive amount of, I mean, we're talking about chaos magic, but it's misleading because chaos magic isn't really chaos magic. Chaos magic is an acknowledgement of a law of compensation and that there's this ultimate order, and that when you introduce distortion into that ultimate order in a directed way, then it follows certain rules. So you have these certain dynamics and then things play out in these different alignments. And it's just, but chaos magic is an acknowledgement of order. What we're seeing here is like just projecting, you know, just mass confusion, trying to confuse things as much as possible. And it's hard to watch Alex Jones without feeling that he's intending to do that in like a very malicious way, and maybe it's rationalized.
I thought it was fairly open and shut that he was CIA disinfo.
Is that right? Yeah.
Are we still putting question marks around that? Yeah.
I mean, I always do. I don't. We make it a point. It was kind of like my mission statement to this show, you know, and people seemed to resonate with it, where it was like the way I put it is I was like, I prefer not to pull out a jump to conclusions board, you know, at any point until enough things pile up that it's absolutely undeniable. I feel like a lot of people cut themselves short. And the problem that I see with a lot of internet radio is that there's kind of these ultimate staple positions that get put in place, and then that becomes the framework. And I don't want to do that in any direction.
And we're certainly not promoting him either, but any very, very far from it. But I don't know. Yeah, I don't know that I can say that's a fact. It sure seems
right. But I mean, there's so many people. How many people contribute to Prison Planet? You know what I mean? It's like, and not all of those people resonate with each other. I mean, he gives people a platform, and it's not all his own. And so you find information. You got a lot of, a lot of information that probably checks out, and a lot of disinfo simultaneously.
A lot of what have yous.
Mod. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, when I say it that way, what I mean is there are. We talk about the deep state as if it's monolithic, and it isn't. I expect that there's information and money coming from some corner of it in that case, which kind of supports your point, which is, well, some of this stuff's going to be real because people are doing that because they actually believe in it. There's there are parts of it somewhere in that kind of patriot movement, I guess, that are, you know, laudable. I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to push it out there too much, but I guess it increased personal responsibility and things. So there are potentially parts of that personality range that are okay. But that's in that Prison Planet sense, some of the stuff is correct just because the money comes from there rather than there. Although I imagine it's fairly well self-supporting now, given how much the supplements cost.
Right.
Speaking of information, is there a specific reason why you are publishing your books now, Gordon? Was it a matter of finding the time, or do you feel like you are in a position now where you want to put something out there in a different form than your blog? And is there an end game, or where are you with that right now?
The books emerged out of one of the, well, the books emerged as a result of magic, frankly. I didn't both publishers, so Llewellyn and Scarlet Imprint, came to me, and they came to me within 70 hours of each other and 70 hours of getting my exit from... I used to work for Yelp because they acquired the German startup that I work for, so my shares vested, and I got these two book offers within 70 hours, like with the exit right in the middle of it. And I'm like, well, having done this for a little while, that's magic. That's an indication that I should write these two books, which is what I was supposed to do. Wait, what year is this? Year before last? Yeah. And I only got 3 months into that process. And they were probably the best 3 months of my life, because they were sort of in the, I'd be in the British Library, you know, reading all these old Egyptological reports, and I'd be at the photocopiers or what have you and turn around and look out across the place and go, I can't believe this is actually my life. Like, I can't believe this happened. But then I got a really good job through some sort of friends that I couldn't turn down, because it was essentially a dream job, sort of 3 or so months into it. And it kind of worked. It was book time, just as it's Trump time. As for now, I'm going to be doing this full time I've got a book coming out this month called Pieces of Eight, which is kind of like the final of, not that the other two books are in any way related or part of a trilogy or anything, but if you read the first three, it kind of unlocks the unwritable book four. And then there's a couple of other projects I want to work on, because I've had a couple of good exits that allow me to do this full time for the next little while, at least until I get bored. What I'm finding about full time writing I miss humans at some point. I hate commuting and all that when you're actually doing work. Much of it is boring, but then by the same token, sort of, it turns out I'm more social than I expected.
Now, Alan put out two volumes of the Sync book over the last 5 years, where each volume had 26 different authors, for the most part taken from internet blogs, talking about the subject of synchromysticism. And I think it was important work for the time, but the numbers on that were, what would you say, Alan, as far as sales? I'm just trying to gauge the magical marketplace.
Oh, it's minuscule. Yeah. This is not something that turns into a job.
And but... I'll have you know, having spoken to Chris Knowles about book publishing, he actually says our numbers were good for what they were. Like, he's like, oh, he was impressed that we did that well. So, whereas yeah, I was it, like, wow, this is a tiny little ripple. And he was like, oh my God, you did that much? So,
yeah.
Right.
These things can sell in the high hundreds. You know, it's this is not, and it's not a big deal. Like, it's actually never been the case that ever, as far since, you know, Gutenberg, that there's been a 50 Shades of Grey of magic. It just doesn't really. It's not interesting enough to a wide enough group of people, which is completely fine. I say that, and when I go on shows that are kind of like, say, Higher Side Chats with Greg, and there's a interest in learning about magic but not practicing, or interested in hearing from a magical perspective, and I sort of underline that this is well and truly a niche pursuit, and I'm not, you know, no one's seeking converts, no one's seeking to kind of grow the footprint of Western magic. The reality is, especially once you've reached, you know, adulthood or mid-20s, in most cases, if you haven't found it, or if it hasn't found you, it's not going to, and it's not for you, and that's completely fine. So, yeah, this is not a... I'm under no illusions. This is an art project more than anything else.
Well, can I ask a practical question that I think Bill was dancing around by asking those two previous questions? It's like, so if you're writing full time in a niche marketplace, is that sustainable in any way?
Let's find out. Like, I have.
I wish you the best of luck. Obviously. Yeah.
I have some investments I've moved money around out of the exit, and I'll see what I cobble together. What ends up happening is I end up doing consulting work for, you know, other media companies or so on, and those kind of that kind of constellation of things happens. Cool. So that's the general idea at the moment. I don't really. It's weird. You don't really think that far ahead. Like, it was the same when I left Yelp and had pretty much a precise amount of money that was, you know, a year's salary and writing these books. I'm like, well, these two things make sense together. But I didn't really think beyond into the next year. I mean, it's, there's no point, certainly not at this stage of the economy. There's no point in kind of going, oh, what is my five-year plan? I'm just kind of going with it and seeing what happens.
Well, I can see by the dates of your publications that it was obviously intended. And you can try and say that that, you know, is just the way that things played out. But I don't know if I'll buy it. It's too convenient.
Well,
I'm joking.
It caught the current, that's for sure. The two books this year have, it was that, but that's what I mean. It's their time. Like, and if I wind it back sort of 15 months to where they both began, it was another kind of weird confluence of events that sort of had the universe arranged to allow me to have these books out, which have caught the current. And obviously they don't make money. That's not what they never do. But they catch the current and we'll see what happens.
I want to say, because the magical marketplace is seemingly a niche market, but yet for those with eyes to see, it does seem that magic is everywhere right now. It seems to creep up in all facets of popular culture. It seems to have winks. I don't know. It just seems more and more explicit, whether or not people understand what they're including or whether they don't. But the language or the symbolism of it seems to be penetrating. And now, I don't know if that's just a function of my perspective and where I look at into popular culture. I could only be looking at 30% of the pie. But have all of, I think all of us in here, and always, you know, people, David and Alan, see that. Is that something you see in pop culture over in England as well as over in Australia, or do you not see that in pop culture?
No, I definitely do. So there are a couple of things there. I'm obviously biased, but you can logic your way to being a non-practicing magician. The universe is magical as far as I'm concerned. And the response to that is either just to say the universe is magical and carry on with your life, or to practice magic. And again, that's a personal, that's what I mean. So maybe 2% of people who recognize that magic, the universe is magical, will do so. So there's that aspect to it, which is, I think you're seeing it everywhere because it is magical. Otherwise, like, I have logicked my way here as well as experienced my way here, and I think I can defend it. And I sort of say that to people who aren't practicing magicians who are open to the idea, like Alex Sekiris on Skeptico. I'm like, I think the only, at the moment, the best model of reality to land on is to be a non-practicing magician. I think it's the best kind of container description for reality. So there's that bit. As for the appearance of magic in culture, I don't know if you're familiar with Grant Morrison in his Super Gods book had that 11-year sun cycle idea of culture being magical and then not magical. And there's probably something in a way behind that, because we either get really good sci-fi films or we get really good kind of like sword and sorcery films or TV shows or so on. And it's rare that they correlate at the same time. If you look at the sort of sci-fi that was available right when Lord of the Rings came out in the cinema, it was dreadful. But if you look at, say, you know the Richard Gere film, First Night, that abomination? That was out around the same time as we were starting to get things like Fifth Element. Oh, it's a bit earlier than that. But, like, you have good sci-fi and shit sword and sorcery, or vice versa. There is something about – there's something from about 2008 onwards that's become very organic and ayahuascan and –
oh, yeah. Well, that's influencing things.
In culture, in a way that is where we are. And so, yes, I think you're observing correctly that we're in a phase where something in the dream state of Western culture is pivoting back towards this organic magic sense of things, rather than the sort of beaming Democrats in space, Star Trek, The Next Generation. Right. That we might
it's all the, it's the drugs, man. It's like the music. It's like, yeah, from the '60s on, where you're like, you look at the '80s and you're like, oh, it's, oh, you know, coke and reverb and whatever, they go together. And it's like, you know, you can see in the dress styles, all these things. And it's like, you know, when I listen to music, I always ask myself, what's the drug? You know, like with dubstep, you're like, oh, I guess that's GHB and ketamine or whatever, you know? And then you listen to what comes out of ayahuasca. Some of the beautiful stuff you've ever heard is healing, you know, or just, you know, purgative, not in the, you know, bad sense.
The drugs absolutely go along with it. Like, for me, the 60s ended around 1998 when I realized people were no longer taking MDMA. And so for me, like, that 90s MDMA thing, people started doing speed and coke and things. And I drink enough coffee and have a high enough opinion of myself to not be interested in coke, which was that sort of noughties, Sex in the City era that kind of went post 9/11 to about 2008. And now we're kind of actually getting back to, well, marijuana is legal again. Ayahuasca is a spirit, is on a tear all over the planet, presumably trying to save us. And those things go in and out. And, you know, the 80s, as you said, cocaine again, quaaludes, things that
I almost died on ayahuasca. I still recommend it to people. I mean, for real, I spent 5 days in the hospital. They told me I had an hour tops, you know, so at the hour, 2 hour tops, you know, because my intestine almost broke apart because it twisted so tight, you know.
Bill, I know you got to run, man.
You got to go.
Yeah, I got to go. I got to go to class. But Gordon, thank you so much for coming on and talking with us. Feel free to keep going. Yeah, thanks a lot, brother.
Yeah, you're very welcome. It was a pleasure.
All right, later.
Sorry to cut you off.
If something wants to taper your pants, you know, it's probably not very good for you.
Yeah, good thinking. Yeah.
But no, I just, you know, I had a extremely the most horrific experience of my life, and yet I still recognize the very real value of it. I mean, I had taken ayahuasca 8 times before that happened. So it's a trip to have something that almost killed me for real. And then still be telling people, oh, no, you should still take it. You know, happened to me is more very important rare.
It is, but it's also more important than death. Like in Chaos Protocols, one of you said you hadn't read it, or maybe you both haven't. One of the chapters in it is called Becoming Invincible. And it is to sort of navigate the economic reality we're in. Step one is essentially to realize that you are more than your circumstances, and not realize it in, you know, have a priest or Oprah tell you. Realize it via an experience so visceral that you can't get the toothpaste back into the tube afterwards.
Right.
And so if I open the chapter by saying, if Discovery Channel has done a show about ghosts in your house, you can skip it. If you've been abducted by aliens, you can skip it. And if not, the reality is the best way to get there is a qualified shaman, preferably in the jungle, very high dose of, you know, organically delivered dimethyltryptamine will do it. And once you're there, then it repositions what's important in the rest of your life, because things like visits to the bank manager start to get very absurd when you realize how these things are put together.
Hey, can I use that as a jumping off point, just to kind of, I want to reconnect with a question. And again, I want to be very clear, like, you and I don't know each other, so I'm not, I don't have any heart, even, I wasn't even willing to say Alex Jones was a CIA agent. That's how much I'm trying to just remain open to possibilities here. So I'm not, certainly not trying to pigeonhole you. But you had, we've talked with this Pokemon Go in relation, and or whatever, if whether that's a good metaphor or not, but the idea of sensing the invisible. And now that we're talking about ayahuasca, I'm thinking of another sort of story, right? When we Western scientists or historians come in and they say to the Peruvian shaman, how did you come up with this recipe of all the items in the jungle that you could mix together? How did you come up with your recipe for ayahuasca? They say, well, we took this other drug and these beings came out and told us to mix these other two plants, right? So we have this idea of the invisible stepping out and making itself known. And so as someone who's approaching your work, I'm just curious, like, as you're trying to piece together all the I don't know, evidence of what you see, you said earlier, it's the materialists within us that try and reduce it down to, say, UFOs or beings from the sky. I'm sort of curious where you stand on, say, these entities from a magical realms, and then how would you translate that, or if that's even the appropriate thing to do, when we look at things like UFOs, rather than, say, a nuts and bolts, where do you get the sense that we're sort of standing at here? Like, you know, whether that's a extraterrestrial, I've heard crypto-terrestrial, all this sort of stuff. Like, is this just totally all in our fucking heads as a state of consciousness, or do you sort of where do you sit as far as these other entities that we seem to be sharing this consciousness space with?
I mentioned earlier I'm an animist, and I Goldilocks my way to animism from panpsychism through idealism because it is a better match for the data. So I think this all in your head or invisible realms, you actually need to move further up the decision tree past Descartes and past the emergence of that split between mind and matter, which we have. When the shamans of the Amazon say that the spirits, like the kapi vine doesn't have a spirit, it is a spirit.
Right.
It is. And that's an animist model. The universe doesn't have a spirit, it is one.
Right.
So I assert the objective reality to these being, well, not all of, I mean, some stuff is in your head because you are a spirit that has this kind of image-making capacity. So some stuff is in your head. But as for the kind of range of phenomena that appears, you know, I think the most parsimonious description is animism, and I find it very interesting. I was on a show the other day, don't know if it's out yet. The Renaissance magicians were looking for their Prisca Theologia, right? They were looking for the original belief system of mankind, and they thought it was some sort of unfiltered monotheism, inevitably. They thought it was like a cleaner version of Christianity. Turns out there is a Prisca Theologia, and it's animism. That is the first belief mankind has had, and so it sits there right at the beginning of our journey as organisms, and it comes with these stories of trickster beings giving us the quote-unquote arts of hunting and civilization, and it comes with a map of the universe where, as Dr. Kuiper would say, they're not embedded in our world, we're embedded in theirs. And if there's a Prisca Theologia, it's that. And I've kind of spent 20 years pulling together, just not the experience of magic, but the thing that folds ufology and entheogen research and the fact that magic works and all this stuff in most adequately is an animist model rather than the universe is all one mind. I think that starts to break or at least bend. And this is something I love Dr. Bernardo Kastrup, but this is one of the things that I think the idealist model fails at. And I call it Brahmansplaining because you still have to do the same thing materialists do, which is to assert that my experience of my dead grandmother coming to visit me is in some way a perceptual error. Animism allows for a range of wider things to match. Idealism doesn't work very well with the idea that an idol or a fetish is or has a spirit. It can kind of go, well, maybe it's a fragment of the whole single mind thing, and it bends rather than breaks, whereas we have reasonably good Fortean evidence that, and not only that, but a universal practice of drawing spirits or waking spirits in idols and fetishes. But we have reasonably good evidence, like statues of Ganesha drinking, you know, thousands of liters of milk all across northern India in 1995 and what have you. That's bizarre, right? So, yes, I funnily enough, I think there is a at the moment anyway, I'm definitely an animist as a model for how the world works. And it's just one of those, it's, you find your car keys in the last place you look. The reason we don't take animism seriously and why it doesn't have a seat at the big table of philosophy is frankly because New Guinean Highlanders believe it and Jean-Paul Sartre didn't. So there is a right. there is a ghost of anthropological racism that will not allow at the moment, I'm really pushing on it. I want someone, there needs to be a Deepak Chopra of animism, and I'm waiting for him or her to emerge because it's a better match. The reality is it's a better match, and it needs a table. It needs a seat at the table.
That was David bouncing Bohm. Around. That was Krishnamurti, yeah. David Bohm. And the implicit order, like what you're describing, acknowledges emanation and the dynamics of emanation. And so if you're saying, it's an acknowledgement of a continuum of expression from etheric to dense, right?
So like, I don't think it's as emanatory as David Bohm. I think I'm being completely serious when I say, I want someone to come up and assert and philosophically debate the independent awareness of a statue that has had a spirit indwelled in it. I don't want it to be like, I think we are at that stage when you kind of, it's a post-internet version of animism. I think we're at that stage where if you sort of bundle up the worthwhile or the sort of as verified as possible components of the paranormal and the UFOs and consciousness research and so on, if you bundle them together, we need someone who can actually stand up in front of it and go, I think the best description is animism. I don't think it's as emanatory as that.
I'd have to qualify that for days to express why it is that I feel that way. Only having gone deep into Bohm in the past in the context of Krishnamurti, it's this whole thing of that they don't have to say it because they know that if you set up the parameters of your redirecting the mind, that this is where it leads you. And if they say it at all, they kind of hold the person back from receiving it. And so, like, there's all these implications. Like, if you're just to take Krishnamurti's ideas or David Bohm's, the way that they generally get expressed in, like, the Cliff Notes version, and you don't look at specific things that get said along the way, because they're so prolific, and there's so much there, there's enormous implications. So, like, they're telling you to steer clear of this, steer clear of this. Meanwhile, what the essence of those things are telling you to steer clear of is inherent in the implications of where what they're presenting leads.
So, sure, like, you're still using words like mind and Krishnamurti. So you're in idealism where the model. I spent most of the time, because you sort of quickly move through panpsychism as going, this is ineffective as a descriptor, and right. You land on idealism, and the difference I would say between. Idealism doesn't deal with the physical very well. It doesn't really deal with the bodily experience. When I say that Carpi is a spirit rather than has, animists work that way. And so, funnily enough, if you take idealism, so you take Krishnamurti and you swap the word consciousness for spirit, you're about 80% of the way to where I think animism should be. Because,
right.
Again, it is an ineffective... The previous modalities haven't been very good at elevating the necessity and the primacy of physical experience.
Right. See, my issue is that because of the language, because of the way that things are set up, because the subject-object relationship, like, for instance, if you say you have a soul, people are like, well, you know, whatever, you want to express the distinction in the language and you say you are a soul. You know, if anything, your soul has you, but it's not even that. Like, that's why I'm emphasizing emanation, because I'm saying if you're looking at a polarity or you're looking at a continuum, I think even when we say those words, it falls short of what the implications really are. Because if things are going from etheric to dense, where's the end of the continuum in both directions? It doesn't seem to have one. And so it's like, and then you'd say, oh, well, we're going to talk about alien or alien intelligences outside. Is there anything outside? And so it's amazing. Yeah. Like, some of the texts that I've been transcribing from Aramaic, from Zohar, and then Hebrew commentary lately, it's been emphasizing, like, it'll set up the context and saying there's nothing outside there's nothing that's not of the Ein Sof. So saying everything is from the Ein Sof. And then it goes on to be going into this whole thing of the Klippot. But it set up the context to begin with. And because of the way that the language is structured, even then, even though it's a psychedelic language, it's not like what we're dealing with now. It's very interesting to read sometimes because the phraseology isn't what we're generally used to. So we're trying to translate something that doesn't translate, really. You know, but you can see what it's kind of driving at, because it's saying one thing and then the next thing it says seems to contradict. But it's because it's the problem. Like, this is what we're seeing. We're talking about Alex Jones and shit. When somebody makes one point, it's assumed that it's negating it's another point. Whereas really you have a series of corollaries oftentimes. And so something's the corollary to this, the corollary to this. Whereas, like, the way people are pretty divided internally, you know, they're a conflict with themselves, with their own ideas, let alone, like, you know, extends to other people's ideas. It's like people have a hard time accepting that two things could be true at once, let alone an infinitude of things all being true at once. And what is truth in the first place when we're relating to representations through a model and pointing back to something that's more primary, that is inherent in the thing itself, not to get to, like, Kant, you know, but there's truth to that. I mean, Kant's whole thing, the thing in itself, that's significant, you know, and I feel like it does relate to, you know, what anima really amounts to, you know, which is impossible to really encapsulate verbally. Like, you can't really do it. That's why I'm pointing towards Krishnamurti, is because he's emphasizing negation. You know, it's like people are looking for something to affirm something for them so they can add it to their belief system, when really, if we're going to go there, you know, the thing is the thing. Like, you can't.
Right, but then there's, like, layers of – so the way you described it is almost like the layer – so, I mean, in one respect, you're making me realize that my – the way I sort of phrased my question earlier was silly, but it's like it's the same idea of you're sort of stating a starting point, but then also trying to find these sort of levels of distinction or complexity. So if you're saying, right, you start that there's nothing that isn't Ein Sof, and then you talk about these other entities and whatever, it's that same sort of idea as I asked Gordon before, right? So where do we stand then with these other entities as far as what are they? And it's like, right, you could say it all returns to some sort of source, we're all spirit, right? So even the douchebag who's bugging my cell phone, you know, that we can stand here and go like, fuck that guy. Well, right, that guy is still an aspect of myself or of the universal expression. And now I'm getting confused. I know, David, you and I were having a conversation earlier about this idea of the sort of sacrifice for a reason and all that sort of stuff. But
Karam, yeah.
When we say the idea of the unconscious / unintentional, this idea of things that just are being expressed. So if this is the time for Trump, if this is the time for whatever, do we still hold Trump or his supporters responsible for their actions,
right,
as conscious individual spirits, right? So we're making all these levels upon levels upon levels of distinctions of saying, yes, it is this, and yet it's also this. So it's – which is, again, Gordon, just to clarify why I was really trying hard not to pigeonhole you. I just kind of wanted to get this conversation rolling here.
Sure.
So but then,
can I just, like, as for, yeah. I think it's important if we look at, so are Trump supporters, are the people who legitimately want to build a wall between Mexico and the United States, are they responsible for their actions? It's time for Trump the way it was time for the cane toad infestation of Queensland in the mid 20th century.
It's springtime for Hitler.
Basically. So the cane toaded very well, and kind of not necessarily collapsed an ecosystem, but came pretty close. And what I like about the animus model, and actually this is the secret to chaos magic, and you kind of alluded to it earlier, chaos is people think an ecosystem is balance. An ecosystem isn't balance. An ecosystem is chaos. It's in that kind of. If you view chaos ecosystemically, and that's largely how I view the universe is a spirit ecosystem, which means it's Trump time, like it's cane toad time. So yes, we can assert, we can hold them either, not necessarily responsible. Like the trouble again is linguistic. When we say it's Trump time, the immediate assumption, because of how our language and culture is, presumes that there is an angry cloud man somewhere who is singularly arranging for, well, now it's Trump time and now it's this time. It's not. It's cane toad time. It's what happens in an ecosystem. And so, yes, I think we can kind of assert sovereignty and responsibility for actions. And this is, again, why the animism thing, I think, needs a seat at the table. If you view the universe not as a single organism, but as an ecosystem, you start to have new ways of thinking about how responsibility and sovereignty works in the universe.
And then there's usually this idea of the ecosystem is chaotic. Do you then, and again, this is almost what Dave was saying, if you assert one thing, are you saying something else? I just want this as a clarifying question. This is something actually I resonate with pretty strongly, the idea there's a school of thought that comes out of Empedocles, which is that the natural state of existence is chaotic, and that is a system of – that is a loving universe, and anything that is orderly, you have to then impose order upon that system, and that is by definition a violent act.
That is the sin of the demiurge. I agree.
Yeah.
That is actually what Yaldabaoth did. That is always our sin. That's why that's always happening. Because yes, it's the ecosystem, it's chaos.
I want to sort of another question here that I wanted to speak to you about, the idea of as this, you use a term about post-internet animism. And earlier when we were talking about the Pokemon game, you referred to it as like archonic in nature, right? I'm curious, do you feel that, quote unquote, the internet, or, you know, and I know you said you're not a Luddite, neither am I, but just sort of like, can we say there is a spirit of that is emerging in the world through technology, or perhaps, you know, again, I don't know where we're going to make these distinctions. Does my personal computer have a spirit? Does the network of computers itself have a, is that an ecosystem or is that a spirit? I'm sort of curious just to hear any thoughts you might have on that. Maybe
yeah,
even
sure.
AI.
Well, that's where I was going to get to. As to the point, and this is why it just needs a seat at the big table just to see how these ideas thrash around. A post-internet animist model asserts that yes, your computer either does or can have a spirit. As for AI, I find it just the most hilarious cosmic joke. And funnily enough, I think this is a play out of the Gnostic myth as well, that we have the people who are so far, like the furthest along the Aspie spectrum are the ones that are trying to build what a human looks like or behaves like in Silicon Valley, which is AI. Like we're leaving people at the Peter Thiel end of the spectrum to say, hey, look, we're going to replicate exactly a human. You know, I don't know if you guys are the right people for that job. I also don't think, I genuinely do not think that is possible. I think, and because they won't be able to tell the difference between, because they can't with normal humans, they won't be able to tell the difference between an actual authentic human and something that reasonably approximates it for like at a sufficient level for them to interact with. That said, I kind of think the AI model is sort of a spirit trap. I think we will accidentally transduce something potentially quite nasty into this model. I mean, it literally looks like a giant idol or fetish or icon. And if we don't build one that is, you know, a 90% approximation, because humans are highly predictable, we may transduce something from the from the other side that won't go well. But it won't be, like, we can't, it's genuinely the sin of the demiurge. Like, we are trying to build something that has never existed before, and kind of coming back to what we were saying with Ayn Sof, like, everything exists.
Yeah, absolutely. And there was something you said in there about this, you know, this thing that people can't even sense. That remains for myself one of my few shining rays of hope in what otherwise seems like a dire drudging from birth to death. Is there's this idea of like when we look at this system, the abuses of government and black ops and corporate theft and dominance and all this sort of stuff. I mean, like, the whole landscape seems pretty fucking rough. But there's something, you know, I'll be cheesy and I'll quote a line from a Tom Petty song. He says, "You can't steal what you can't feel." It's like when people talk about, you know, the Bilderberg group or the somebody, you know, whatever name, pick your elite figurehead to put onto this overarching system, the demiurge, all this sort of stuff. It's like, can they really actually, you know, steal the spirit of man if they don't even know what that is? They can't right. even they don't even recognize it for what it is.
Between a secret and a mystery, right? I'm sorry to interrupt. Yeah.
No, it's fine. I wrote a post the other month called "Gnosticism is the Map, Animism is the Territory," and that's basically what you're saying. The good news is that freedom, especially in the Kali Yuga, like that freedom is one mantra away. There is that sort of V for Vendetta inch that once you find, they can't take.
Yeah. Just, you know, I think the most profound thing that I've ever come across in Zohar is the simple statement that Keter has two right sides. Because if you're acknowledging the emanations, you say, okay, well, you got Aleph on one side and Beit on the other as the two extensions from Chokhmah and Bina, right? And you say it has two right sides, it implies that they're both spirit, because they're both Aleph. So the Beit being the structure, being the house, is actually still the spirit. And so in that acknowledgement, we're seeing this duplicit representational model, and we can recognize that really there's really only one tower here. There's really only one pillar here. But we're taking that one, we're kind of like folding it out, and we're relating to the replication of both sides. Like we do a replication of the right and the left, not realizing that ultimately both of them cancel out in the center, and that it's two right sides because of the way that things come into form through the spiral. And so the spiral goes in this direction. So either way you're looking at of any symmetry, you're still seeing a spiral going in one direction. We see we relate to the two hemispheres, and from our limited perspective, we're on one side, we're like, oh, you flush the toilet and it goes this way. Oh, you flush the toilet and it goes this way. But ultimately, there's only one movement. And so that's the paradox of existence. But, you know, it's kind of this implied thing where it's like recognizing how something can have two right sides is really the key to the whole conundrum, in a sense, you know. But that's not for the left brain to make a belief out of and to make a representation out of, because that's just more of the same. So it's kind of like this demand that can't be met through any means that we usually relate to solving an equation through, you know.
Well, so that metaphor we used at the beginning of the show, or well, that I used at the beginning of the show, about pulling things up from the surface of the ocean, they're intact in the ocean, and you take them up and they sort of rust and fall apart in your hands at the surface. It's that's why magic is structured, or the Zohar is structured the way it is, because these ideas only exist here, or these notions can only exist under the ocean, and if you left brain them to the surface, it doesn't work.
That's El Dorado. You go to El Dorado, you get the gold, you go to bring it back, it turns to dirt or whatever.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah, they do the same thing in the myth of the bluebird of happiness, right? She tries to return the bluebird, and then it's just like an ordinary bird. And yeah, this is a common sort of theme throughout all this stuff. So it's like, that question I was sort of asking earlier about, like, where do we draw these distinctions? It almost would seem, at least as some sort of model here, that there is a, for lack of a better term, like a liminal space that is distinct from the material space, to continue with this sort of metaphor.
For me, like, one of the things I would want to see as in a serious, 21st century version of animism is a re-elevation of Charles Fort's idea that everything exists on a spectrum of real to unreal. So that's how Carpi is a spirit and can also behave non-physically, because you kind of have a sliding scale of where they are. That would hold with an ecosystemic universe. So that's kind of how I see that working, and how I can assert that you are a spirit rather than have one. You're just the kind of diplomatic outpost component of your spirit right now.
Mm-hmm.
And would that spectrum perhaps be different for... So as you say, like you gave the example of the vine, would you say, oh, I don't know... And I don't mean this as an insulting example, I'm just trying to pull something out of my ass here. Like, say the unicorn or the leprechaun, you know, they exist much further on that spectrum of the unreal, whereas Hillary Clinton exists on this, you know, super unfortunately, yeah, all too real space, or you know, something like that.
That would be precisely Fort's assertion, because you know, you don't rarely see unicorns, but sometimes you do.
Sometimes you do, right?
This kind of comes back to
this. No, absolutely. Yeah.
And this, funnily enough, I think is in an inexplicable way inevitably associated with Dr. Kripal's assertion that the universe is linguistically structured. And we see this idea, people attempting, or cultures attempting to grapple with this idea that you've got the Memphite theology and obviously Hebrew theology and, Southern Eurasian notions of the linguistic beginning of the universe. If we're in this sort of spectrum ecosystem, then things move not just in and out, but around linguistically. And so that's the model that I think I want to use as a storehouse, at least for the foreseeable future, for how we fold, as I was saying, magic and the paranormal and ufology and consciousness studies and flat out normal science. Like, in and kind of sit it together, because I think it's the best shaped storehouse to work with for the next little while. Because it's, again, it's the last one left as well. Idealism kind of worked, but like it's the storehouse, the door still opens on it, and the lock still kind of works, but it doesn't fit things as neatly as animism might.
And this is maybe this might be incredibly obvious to you, but this is just something that is sort of floating through my mind as we're talking here. Like, say, why it'd be really difficult to reenact something in a scientific experiment, because a laboratory is cold, hard, left brain, you know, the sterile environment, total dominating the conditions. Whereas, say, magic, you know, I've heard a magician say half the reason that you're putting on, you might put on a fancy outfit or make a magic wand or even some of the rituals that you're doing is just to basically trick. It's saying magic is a natural ability within us, but we're so rooted in our materialist egoic existence that you have whatever little trick you can use to shake yourself out of it. That could be psychedelics, that could be putting on a fancy dress, that right. could be doing whatever it might be, something to make yourself. It's like why Superman doesn't have to put on a, he could be Superman in a glasses and a suit and tie, but he doesn't. He has to change his outfit to fucking fly, right? Because we need to do something to trick ourselves to say, there's a distinction. I was Clark Kent, but right now in this moment, I'm going to be Superman and I'm going to be able to commit this magical act that maybe it would be harder for me to do in my day-to-day doldrum existence. So this idea that the laboratory is basically the embodiment of that doldrum controlled environment, whereas the ritualistic space is literally trying to shake that up as much as possible. And of course those can get drowned in their own dogmatic, you know, why is the Catholic Church is doing a billion rituals a day. How much is their magic still potent, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's certainly a common interpretation. It comes with implicit claims about the universe that I think need to be problematized, which is again that idealist asserting that your experience is an illusion or you've fallen away in a mental state. It may well be the case. There is absolutely a performative aspect to ritual magic that the more you because the thing, like, if that's the case, how often does it work before it stops working? On the other side of it, if magic in a universe where you assert sovereignty and separateness to at least some spirits that you deal with, then it's a game of getting their attention, in which case you start to see, and this is, I think, shown in the archaeological record, one of the reasons for starships was that there are components that have survived in Western magic that are inherently conserved through time and through species. Like, so we found in earlier this year in Brunecœur Cave in France, there is a Neanderthal circle in a cave, a magic circle in a cave that's 177,000 years old. So the magic circle in Europe predates humans in Europe. That's interesting. That's interesting from, again, coming back to, rather than we just assume that there's an assumption that the idealist model about everything's mind and the game is to untrick your mind. That may not be the case because the Neanderthals didn't have human minds, and you know they probably weren't scientists or you know having to try and alter their consciousness away from Pokemon Go to magic in a cave. I think there is something that asserts an external reality about the conservation of comparatively few forms in magic that suggest instead that it's a system of getting the attention of something else.
So you're taking like the Land of the Lost idea of that the Sleestaks built the magic table in the cave before the proto hominids arrived?
Well, kind of. I'm taking a Field of Dreams approach.
Yeah.
If you build it, they will come, and they did, and then we did. And funnily enough, I don't know if you have listen to the episode with Jack Hunter, but if not, you should get him on as a guest anyway. He's a UK academic. And we would, hang on a minute, I've got someone at the door. Can I just, we'll hold that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Go for it.
Come in.
I should probably start to wind this down anyway.
Sorry, that was a post. I'll start again from the point about Jack Hunter. If you listen to the episode I had on Rune Soup with Jack Hunter, we were talking about a sort of mid-20th century Italian anthropologist called Ernesto Di Martino, and he posited, and I think this fits in the model with Field of Dreams and kind of knocking animism around as an explanation, that cultures that are more open to magical or paranormal experiences have more magical and paranormal experiences. So this suggests that there's something else that's halfway back to tricking the mind on an individual basis that is kind of closer to getting their attention. The more of it we do, and funnily enough, as a result, I view as quite positive, just as what we were talking about before, the reemergence of magic into popular culture in the West, because if this hypothesis holds, then we're going to get more magic and more effective magic.
Right. There's an issue between the two. So if you're looking at the formative order versus the sustaining order, is the tree of life. You have the 12 diagonals and you have the Gimel, which they relate to as the 13th. And so you have this system. There's a magical system that relates to that, that utilizes that to direct the emanated flow in a sense. But then there's the formative order that's actually the organism itself. And so when we're relating to magic, you have what would be sleight of hand magic would be more like related to the diagonals, because though it works and though it's functional, like if you're relating to currency as money versus currency like electricity is literally like what we're talking about. So like if you have a system of currency that's money, you can rig it, you can change it, you can do all kinds of things, which is a form of magic. No doubt there. And Crowley was very into that. Yet at the same time, there's a, you know, so it's just the distinction is huge. When you're relating to the nullification of the Klipot as the intention of the magical working, that would be like leaning way in the direction of acknowledging the formative order, because there's, an aspiring to salvation there. Yet to take in the material sense through mind models and whatnot and the consensus consciousness, that's another. Do you see what I'm driving at there?
Yeah, kind of. Again, this I think that was reasonably well described. It also reminds me why I don't really resonate with Kabbalah stuff, because it does seem overly complex.
Well, there's two radically different schools, and that's actually literally what I'm saying. So if you're talking about traditional Kabbalah, it comes across with an entirely different intention than European Kabbalah. And yet for most people, they when they want to learn about Kabbalah, they go towards the European, and the European will often be presented as though it was traditional. And so you have this really intense dichotomy, and it actually breeds a lot of anti-Semitism.
Really?
Because people don't know what the intentions of the original Kabbalists were, and they're looking at the intention of either European Kabbalists or even more contemporary Kabbalists who have different relationship to what constitutes magic in the first place. So somebody's looking for material gain or to gain power or whatever, and that's what magic is. And then somebody who knows nothing of the subject goes to look into, well, what is Kabbalah? And this is what they come across. It gives a very bad impression. Especially of the Jews, you know, because you're like, oh, well, what are these people trying to do here? You know, whereas
I'm following that. Yeah. Okay.
For me, like I look at commentary from the Zohar from, around the late 15th, early 16th century from the Ramak, and I see this repeated intention with the nullification of the Klipot. And like, this is what we're doing, is we're reuniting Za'er and Shekhinah, the masculine and the feminine. And we're doing this, you know, this is the aim. And then you look at Crowley, or you look at Israel Regarde, you look at all these people, and it's not even communicated at all that that's what the intention is. In fact, it's kind of like ambiguous what the intention is. And you're like, well, what is it, just to sustain the empire? Because it seems like this is actually more like they're looking to, you know, reconcile this conundrum in the traditional system. And so, yeah, it's a very significant point. Yeah.
Well, I know we have to sort of wrap this up, and I don't want to leave that as a, that's an excellent sort of distinction to make there, and I think this has been a. I appreciate all the sort of distinctions that you guys have laid out today, but I also sort of want to give Gordon. I want to give you an opportunity before we just bid adieu here. Is there anything? I know, obviously, you got a new book in the works and one that came out recently. Is there anything you'd sort of like to put out there, or even put a nice ribbon on sort of some of the topics we've discussed today as a thought, or whatever you'd like to sort of, I want to just kind of give you the floor here as we sort of wind down.
Yeah, sure. I mean, obviously it's been an absolute pleasure, having the chat. And, I think the last couple of shows I've been on, because I've been on quite a few this week, because I spent the last month and a half in transit, so I sort of like smashed them all into the 1 week. I do get the sense that there is a something wider is going on, and the conversations we're having now are at a next level up compared to where they were, say, 4 or 5 years ago, when it comes to just trying to attempt to model what's going on. I think we can model more data with more humility now. And I see there are a few people, yourselves being some of them, that are kind of part of that journey and making a space for that, or, you know, allowing it to be transduced, which I think is very encouraging. So as for like following up with my stuff, for people who are still interested in listening this far into the show, runesoup.com, the RuneSoup Facebook page. If you want to get in touch, there's contact details on RuneSoup, or I'm better on Twitter than I am on anything else. So that's Gordon_White. And yes, the books, you'll find the information about the books on RuneSoup.
Excellent. We will put up front. I know Bill had tried to give you a little synopsis of your work there at the beginning, but we'll also just throw a quick little intro at the beginning with the website and everything like that. So make sure that there'll be links on the website and all that sort of stuff. And I really hope everyone then just continues to not just, you know, check out your work. And I feel like, but one of the things Dave was saying was, what is the intention, or what is, you know, these ambiguous sort of goals of any of this stuff? I feel like for my part, I'm enjoying that, continuing this conversation, because I feel like that's one of the better things we can do, is continue to hash this out and sort of bounce ideas off each other. And that, at least for me, is a superb pleasure, if not a really somewhat idealistic goal of mine. So.
No, I second that goal. Sounds brilliant.
Good. So,
we appreciate your time so damn much. And I know Will had to run to class, but I want to thank him for pushing to make this happen. I know he's been following your work for a long time. And Bill used to be was a co-host of the show for a long, long time. And he sort of he was pushing to make this happen. So we sort of wanted to make sure to have him here as much as he could. So. I want to thank Bill for joining us. I want to thank Gordon. And David, it's been a pleasure getting to reconnect with you today. It's been too long, man.
Totally. I appreciate you being able to hang with our freeform style, where have kind of a sister radio show called 42 Minutes. It's way more just interview, this is the thing, whereas like we like to have a real dialogue here. So thank you for going along.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a pleasure.
All right, boys, have a wonderful day. Great, go ahead and talk to you both.
Cool, thanks. See ya.
I shook the hand of the president and the Pope in Rome. I've been to parties where I've had to be flown. They said everything was sacred, nothing was profane, and money was something that you'd throw off the back of trains. Oh, always keep a dime in your mind. You got to always keep a dime in your mind. Wherever you may wander, wherever you may roam, you got to always keep a dime in your mind. Steam of the gravy with little fried pearls, floating like a necklace on a beautiful girl. Jonah says thanks to the food and the land, and oh, so ever great.
Thank you for listening to this broadcast from SyncBook Radio. If you enjoyed this episode, there's so much more content waiting for you at thesyncbook.com. Our newest episodes are always free, and members get access to our full archive of over 600 hours. You'll find all of this, as well as our books and videos, at thesyncbook.com.
She's got the milk of humankind and the fat of the lamb. Scared like a baby, but she drives like a man. She lives outside of Natchez and she operates a crane. She's like a wrecking ball that no longer connected to the chain. Oh, Zarella Samuel says she almost never prayed since she lost her right arm, blown off in a Pinkerton rain. Then they lashed her to a windmill with all three fingers dained. Now she's 102, drinking mint juleps in the shade. Everybody always keep a dime in your mind. In your mind.